Welcome to Lung Cancer Considered, the official podcast of the International Association for the Study of Lung Cancer. ISLC is a global organization dedicated to research and practice advances in thoracic oncology, celebrating our 50th anniversary this year. You can find all our podcasts on SoundCloud, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and ISLC.org under the ISLC News tab. I'm your host, Dr. Stephen Liu. Hello, this is Lung Cancer Considered, the official podcast of the ISLC. I'm Dr. Stephen Liu, Director of Thoracic Oncology at Georgetown University. Today, we'll discuss some of the emerging agents with promise for small cell lung cancer. Small cell is a challenging subtype of lung cancer to treat. Most of our patients present with extensive stage disease, where our current standard of care is chemoimmunotherapy. The PD-L1 inhibitors atezolizumab and durvalumab, when added to platinum plus etoposide chemotherapy, improved survival and have led to long-term survival for a subset of patients. Both of these checkpoint inhibitors are approved by the US FDA and the EMA, with multiple other checkpoint inhibitors around the world showing similar impact. But unfortunately, most patients do not achieve that long-term survival, and the need for novel treatment approaches is clear. Fortunately, the field continues to advance. There are several novel agents showing a lot of promise for small cell. To help navigate through this field, I'm joined today by two of the top global experts in small cell lung cancer. My first guest is Dr. Luis Pazarez, the head of medical oncology at Hospital Universitario 12 de Octubre, associate professor at the Universidad Complutense, and head of the lung cancer unit at the CNIO in Madrid, Spain. Luis, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Stephen. Nice to be here.
I'm also joined by Dr. Ann Chang, associate professor at Yale School of Medicine and the associate cancer center director for clinical initiatives at the Yale Cancer Center. Ann, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Luis, perhaps we could start by talking about our current standards off study. How do you approach someone who has relapsed small cell lung cancer after chemoimmunotherapy? Do you consider platinum sensitivity in your decisions?
Certainly, I tend to consider platinum sensitivity. I would say that for those patients that really had a long initial response, let's say with a chemotherapy-free interval of 6, 9, 12 months, I tend, out of a clinical trial, to offer rechallenge with carboplatin and etoposide. For those patients with actually short-term response or even primary progression, I tend to go to an alternative treatment. And I have a number of opportunities here. A topo I inhibitor, I tend to use more irinotecan as compared to topotecan. Some other patients are offered, let's say, Taxol on lurbinectedin as well on a patient name program. The drug is not currently available in Europe.
And what about here in the U.S., where we have different drugs approved? What's your current standard approach, second line, off study?
Second line, I agree with Luis that if patients had a good response to platinum etoposide, say in the 6-month free interval, then I would retreat with platinum etoposide. And certainly if a patient had limited stage and then progressed within that time frame, it might be a little bit less. I'd want to use the platinum doublet plus immunotherapy. For patients who are less than 6 months or 3 to 6 months, you know, always looking for clinical trials, and we do have the luxury of having them right now, so that's great. We'll talk more about them. But certainly lurbinectedin, I think, is the next agent of choice as an FDA-approved drug. Although the trial was a relatively small one, it's pretty well tolerated, and I've had patients who've gotten good response to that.
You know, I think you bring up an interesting subtle point there. About a third of our patients will present with limited stage small cell, and unfortunately, most of those patients will relapse. In those settings, I also like using platinum etoposide after a limited stage relapse, because really, it's the only FDA-approved opportunity to introduce immunotherapy is with platinum-based chemotherapy. And so I think that's a nice point. But certainly, the approval of lurbinectin in the U.S. gives us another option here. Luis, there's a lot of clinical circumstances, and you know, each case is unique. When brain metastases are present at the time of relapse, how does that impact your approach?
Well, I think this is something of relevance, I would say. If the patient is really symptomatic, if the brain metastases are symptomatic, I tend to go to radiotherapy. If the patient is asymptomatic, I may consider to start chemotherapy first. And that, of course, is going to depend as well if the patient had been treated or not with PCI before. In relation to the systemic therapy of choice, I tend to prefer in patients with brain metastasis other drugs as compared to lurbinectedin, which is a drug that we have been working quite a lot and quite like it in this setting, but maybe not for those patients with brain metastasis. We have some data suggesting that is not the best scenario for that agent, I would say.
And are there drugs that you reach for when the brain metastases are present?
Yeah, I think that, you know, if the patient's on maintenance immunotherapy, I agree with Luis that, you know, we would consider focal treatment with Gamma Knife, for example, and continued surveillance for essentially oligoprogressive disease. But if that isn't the option, we're thinking about changing systemic therapy, then, you know, it's going back to the tried and true. Sometimes I would use temozolomide. Sometimes I'd use topotecan or taxane. I do think lurbinectin doesn't really have the data, certainly not, you know, patients in the initial clinical trial did not have brain metastases. So that is, I would agree, is not the option that I would jump to.
You know, while it is good to have active second-line agents, and there's a long list in our guidelines, even though most not approved in that setting, clearly we need better drugs. We need novel approaches. And what we're really lacking here is durability. There's a new class of agents that's emerged that's generating a lot of enthusiasm, and that's the bispecific T-cell engagers. I think the farthest agent along in development is tarlatamab. You know, Luis, I know you've been involved with this agent from an early stage. Can you explain to the listeners and our audience, how does a T-cell engager like tarlatamab work?
Actually, it's a pretty interesting and quite a smart way to activate T-cells. So tarlatamab is a bispecific drug, which is binding in one end to an antigen on the surface of the small cell lung cancer cell, which is in that case to DLL3, which is expressed in most of the small cell lung cancer cells in the surface. And on the other end, it's actually binding to CD3 on the T cell and is activating the T cell on a non-canonical mechanism, not depending on antigen presentation, which is very smart because, as you know, very often small cell lung cancer is having downregulation of class 1 molecules, and therefore antigen presentation is an issue here. Once this T cell is activated, it's actually able to kill the tumor cell.
We really live in an era where synthetic biology, where rational drug design has made so many advances possible. I agree, very clever design. And maybe you can break down the efficacy for us. Does this drug work?
Actually, the early results with tarlatamab are pretty encouraging. The phase 2 DeLLphi 301 trial showed encouraging response with about 40% overall response rate and 70% disease control with progression-free survival around 5 months, and some of those patients having prolonged benefit. With this data right now, tarlatamab is actually under FDA review for accelerated approval, and I think it's very promising. And, you know, I think we've all had patients on these clinical trials. There are some side effects, but earlier, more with the earlier cycles and with these, some of the prolonged responses, we're really excited about this drug.
Luis, can you maybe speak to some of your own experience in terms of the responses that you've seen? What kind of responses are these? Are these transient? Are these durable? Do they occur quickly?
So, I mean, responses are happening, as is being said, in some 40% of the patients. I mean, I would say the more relevant thing about response are they are really typically long-lasting. They were, the median duration of response in the initial phase 1 trial was longer than 12 months. And I think those data are being replicated on the phase 2 study as is being said here. Importantly, those long lasting responses actually do have a clear impact on survival. In the initial phase one trial, median survival was exceeding 13 months. Those data had been validated on the phase two trial, and we hope to see some more mature data on those trials in upcoming meetings, particularly in terms of survival updates.
Yeah, that's always what strikes me when I look at these data and these swimmers plots. It's, you know, it's not so unusual for us to see responses with different agents, but they tend to be short. The durability seen here, I think, is extremely exciting and really optimistic. But always, you know, the flip side of that coin, we think about efficacy, we immediately have to reconcile toxicity. Luis, what are the toxicities that we worry about with a drug like tarlatamab?
So I would say the most common toxicities includes CRS, typically low grade, but some cases of grade 3 have been seen. ICANN, but also one-third of the patients do have some loss of appetite, some constipation, and some fever. In terms of CRS, some 50% of the patients do have CRS, and as I said, typically they happen in cycle 1, less often in cycle 2. They are typically grade 1 or 2, and we have one or two patients with grade 3. It's not a big issue. The main problem is the uncertainty. When one patient is developing fever, you don't know if this grade 1 CRS is going to progress to grade 2 or to grade 3. So you have to actually monitor the patient pretty well. Other than that, treatment is pretty straightforward. You need to maybe use some steroids, some hydration, to be sure that the patient is not getting hypotension. And in the initial studies, we have to use tocilizumab in about 5 to 10% of the patient, depending on the dose of tarlatamab or tarlatamab we have used. In terms of ICANN, CRS is typically happening in cycle 1 or cycle 2. It's more frequent with higher dose as compared with the lower dose, the 10 milligram dose, which is the one typically used. And it's less than one-third of the patients that do have grade 1 or 2. And we didn't see actually grade 3 toxicities in terms of ICANNs with the 10 milligram dose. So I would say is pretty well tolerated, but it's important to early recognize that. And for the time being, at least, you're not experienced. I think we have to monitor the patient for some time after the treatment is administered.
Yeah, these are a little different than some of our classic checkpoint inhibitors in terms of the toxicities. And I think those are the two big ones, Luis, that caught our eye. You know, CRS, cytokine release syndrome, ICANS, or immune effector cell-associated neurotoxicity syndrome. These are toxicities that I think most lung cancer physicians maybe not used to. And as you mentioned, it really is early recognition, intervention when needed. But yeah, I agree. It was reassuring to see that these really do seem to be low-grade toxicities and the high-grade are fairly rare.
The good thing is that in the phase two trial, we actually have a cohort of patients where we use, let's say, a shorter period of monitoring. So the patient were given the drug, and during the initial infusions were monitored for some 24 hours. And I think in the initial cohort of patients treated, it looks like it's a reasonable strategy. Of course, we have to consider that all the centers that were included in this program had already had some experience. So that is going to be some important issue that all of us as the doctors, the treating team, nurses, and so on, we have to be educated on how to manage those toxicities that are not very often seen in our clinical practice with some other agents.
Yeah, that definitely caught my eye as well. And I think that we didn't talk about that enough at the time of the presentation, is that third cohort with the shorter stay. You know, I think the fear of some was that with a shorter stay, would we see some of those grade ones and twos flip over to grade threes? And we didn't see that. We did not see that, which is good. But I think your point that this is done at very select centers is a big one. And so, Anne, let's talk about sort of some practical issues. We've got a response rate about 40%, some durable responses, but some unique toxicities. you think that there are barriers to delivering this new type of agent?
I think that certainly, as mentioned, the education component is going to be huge. The community knows how to give drugs that they know how to manage CRS for hematologic cancers. So I think the lung cancer docs will have to learn this too. But as mentioned, I think that the looking at when the toxicities occur, providing a really good education plan, whereas the initial trials required a hospitalization stay, the cohort of 8-hour monitoring seems to be doing well. And I think that, ultimately the plan will be for 3 or 4 hours of monitoring. So it will really depend on a great education plan for thoracic teams to be able to, educate patients in terms of taking Tylenol, of hydrating them, of, making sure that they can call in for any questions that they have and being able to see them and manage their symptoms promptly. So I think that our docs can do it. But again, it will be important to have a very thorough, comprehensive education plan around it.
Yeah, I think that training is going to be critical. Luis, when we look at this drug and sort of the landscape of small cell lung cancer, what's your perspective on the impact that this drug could have for our patients if it's approved? And, is this a drug we give by itself, or are there rational combinations that are in the horizon?
Well, I think initially we're going to use this drug in pre-treated patients. And the most striking thing about tarlatamab is, as we have said before, is that the duration of responses seems to be quite prolonged, and particularly has a huge impact in survival. Of course, I'm talking on single cohort trials without a control, but so far, those median survival exceeding a year are uncommon with other agents. We have seen drugs and strategies that do induce responses in 30-40% of the patients with relapsed small cell lung cancer, but truly median survival exceeding 8 or 9 months is very, very rare in small cell lung cancer. So for that reason, I think this drug may occupy first the second, third line space. Later, I would see this drug coming earlier into the disease. For that, I'm pretty sure that we have to combine that with other agents. We are doing now trials based on preclinical experience that do have additivity and synergy with other agents, such as PD-L1 inhibitors. Lorbanectedin is also being studied in some experimental scenarios. And we are now even doing phase one trials where the drug are combined with PD-L1 inhibitors. That could be a fantastic combination for the maintenance setting. And in terms of first line, I think we may test the hypothesis combining with chemotherapy or with chemo-IO, I would say better. The only thing is that in that case, we probably have to start tarlatamab not in cycle one, because typically small cell lung cancer patients are not very healthy before starting treatment. And I would feel somehow uncertain about adding the toxicity of tarlatamab to those patients at this stage. Likely, we will start with this type of T-cell engagers in cycle two or so, at least.
Yeah, I agree. A little concern up front, just sort of given the amount of tumor there. And a lot of excitement here. There are other T-cell engagers that are in development. This is not the only drug in this class. Can you comment on a little bit about what we're seeing with those drugs?
Sure. Super, super exciting. We have bispecific antibodies, trispecific antibodies. Boehringer has a bispecific DLL3 targeted agent that's been tested in small cell, has about a 25% response rate, 50% disease control rate. Harpoon has a trispecific that binds to DLL3, CD3, and albumin. That was presented at ESMO 2023 and showed about a 30% response rate in small cell patients, very well tolerated. Roche has a bispecific with TIM3, and there are other approaches that involve LAG3 and B7H3 bispecifics. You know, I think that I would comment there. One is that some of these drugs are also being used not only for small cell, but neuroendocrine tumors, large cell neuroendocrine tumors. I think that's sort of a rare subset that we don't exactly know what to do with. And I think that, you know, these agents take advantage, as Luis said, cleverly, of the fact that small cell patients don't have a lot of tumor infiltrating lymphocytes, and PD-L1, for example, expression is very low. So I think we have to figure out a different way to approach these tumors and taking the immune system directly to the tumor cell seems to be an approach that is so far looking very good.
It's good to have options, other drugs in the space. Luis, are there meaningful differences between these agents, or they're all pretty similar?
So at present, I think there is very little difference between the agents, at least with the evidence we have in the clinic. There are some of the new generation agents are tri-specifics, so they are also stimulating signals such as CD28 or 4-1BB, and I think that's maybe a relevant way to press on the accelerated pedal for the immune function to go over. There are even tetra-specific, so I don't know. We have to see into the future if those strategies are paying off. At present, I would say they seem to be somehow similar, the whole class of agents.
And thinking of these T-cell engagers, are there biomarkers under investigation for these drugs?
That's a great question. I think initially in the development, the drugs were being given specifically for DLL3 positive patients, for example. But in the more recent trials, it's seen that actually all comers are having responses, and that's not a requirement for response. So I do think that it would be helpful to have a biomarker. In this case, I'm not sure that there's one that's clearly available for the effect to predict the effect of these drugs.
Yeah, I hope so. And you know, while the T cell engagers are maybe like a form of targeted therapy, and that they do have a target, we're not really using biomarkers for their delivery yet. Luis, do we know anything about the duration of treatment? Is this something that you have to give indefinitely?
I don't think we have now a lot of robust data in terms of duration of therapy. I think because those drugs tend to be well tolerated after the initial courses, if the patient is responding and is having no side effects, we tend to maintain them till disease progression. This is a question we have to answer maybe into the future. At present, we tend to give the drug as the patient is benefiting.
And we've also seen some encouraging activity with antibody drug conjugates, like ifinatamab deruxtecan. Can you describe the structure, Anne, and how the ADCs work?
Sure. Ifinatamab deruxtecan, that's a mouthful. It's basically a first-in-class antibody drug conjugate that's directed against B7H3. And B7H3 is a transmembrane program that belongs to the B7 family, which also includes PD-L1. And it's overexpressed in a number of different cancer types, but specifically in small cell, it's about 65% of tumors that have a moderate to high expression of B7H3. And this is a marker that's associated with poor prognosis, disease progression, lower overall survival. And in this ADC, the humanized antibody is conjugated to a TOPO1 inhibitor payload. And so it's a way to, we know that PD-L1 is not a marker that's overexpressed in small cell, but B7H3 is. And so this is a possibility of getting to the tumor cell and being more effective, having an agent that's more effective in targeting small cell.
Luis, have you been impressed by the early data from ifinatamab deruxtecan?
I have to say the data here are pretty impressive. The tolerance is, I would say, reasonable, and activity in more than 50% of the patients that had been extensively treated is pretty impressive. Not only that, I think this drug has opportunities for combination. I mean, if you compare this ADC with a topo one poison payload, activity is much better as compared to traditional topo one inhibitors such as topotecan and irinotecan. We have actually done trials into the past, for example, with combination of topo one inhibitors with ATR inhibitors or with lurbinectedin, with quite impressive initial results, I would say encouraging results initially. And maybe this agent is actually a good drug to combine as well with lurbinectedin or ATR inhibitors. So I'm pretty impressive with the activity of the drug as single agent in pretreated patients. And I see potential for combination therapy even to go earlier into the disease.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, a pretty strong signal from response. And what about safety? Anything we're concerned about with IDXD?
In that initial phase 1-2 trial, I mean, there were about 20-some patients with small cell. Grade 3 or higher treatment adverse events were about 30-35%. Mostly nausea, fatigue, anemia, vomiting, decreased appetite were seen overall. There was one grade 2 that was a treatment-related ILD, and certainly that interstitial lung disease with antibody-drug conjugates is something that we're looking out for. But I think overall pretty well-tolerated. And I think there's a clinical trial coming up seeing whether, you know, could we combine something like this in the first line and get rid of etoposide. Wow, what a concept. So very interesting.
It's only been 50 years, right, Anne?
So, yeah.
Luis, antibody drug conjugates, certainly a hot topic, a lot of interest in their ability to concentrate drugs, to, you know, deliver potent levels of drug given the high DARs. Are there other ADCs that are showing promise in small cell?
Yes, certainly. There are a couple of them that had already shown some relevant activity. I would like to maybe emphasize here the potential of the 66 ADC. 66 is a molecule that is expressed in the surface of small cell lung cancer cells very often, particularly in some transcriptomic subsets, such as those with more neuroendocrine subtype. And these ADCs had been shown to be effective in some, with responses in the initial phase 1 trial in some 25% of the cases. Safety profile is reasonable. Some GI toxicity, myelosuppression is also, I would say, something to be careful, asthenia and so on. The other type of ADCs are those directed to TROP2, such as SASI, Tuzumab, Govitican. The initial data with the drug, with this drug, are a bit less impressive. Responses a bit lower than 20%, actually 17%, and toxicity profile of the drug is pretty well known, as we have been using that for a number of years now in breast cancer and in some other diseases, including trials in non-small cell lung cancer and so on.
And we're talking about a couple promising agents here. And, you know, one thing that hasn't come up in terms of using these is biomarkers, very different from non-small cell, where it really dictates what we do. Do we have any biomarker-driven approaches that are ready in small cell?
Yeah, I think that at ASCO last year, 2023, we saw a SWOG trial 1929 that showed that for patients who had Schlafen 11 positive, that they responded to a PARP inhibitor plus immunotherapy in the maintenance setting, and that's based on preclinical data that those Schlafen 11 patients do have a proclivity to the PARP inhibitors. So I think that we have now quite a bit of data that shows that there is heterogeneity in small cell tumors. I think we are limited to some extent compared to non-small cell because of the availability of our of tumor tissue. But my hope is that we'll be able to develop more biomarker-specific biomarker-driven approaches. Certainly the paper from Gay and Lauren Byers from MD Anderson looking at the IMpower133 trial showed that retrospectively looking, there are some patients who of a certain subtype that had a better duration of survival when they had immunotherapy than versus placebo. So I think that PD-L1 has not been the marker that's has not been as successful in small cell as it has been in non-small cells, and particularly because it's not really expressed in PD-L1. Sorry, particularly because it's not expressed in small cell tumors. So as we learn more about the as we get more tissue and learn more about the biomarkers, I think we'll have more biomarker-directed approaches. Right now, it seems like a lot of the antibody drug conjugates, which in the initial phases were limited to patients who only expressed that target, now we are seeing that those drugs are effective in all comers, and I think that's the case for some of the AbbVie drugs that Louise also mentioned earlier.
Yeah, part of the limitation with development is that we need better drugs and. We need more novel active agents in small cell lung cancer. Luis, what other drugs should we be watching in this small cell space?
So, I mean, in my opinion, what we have seen with T-cell engagers is really something very relevant. For the first time, we have seen that T-cell engagers is working in solid tumors, not only solid tumors, in one of the most immunosuppressive solid tumors, such as small cell lung cancer. So, if this is working here, I think we should try this strategy more. We have to produce some more T-cell engagers against other cell surface antigens, and a number of them have been already identified. I mean, let's say 6/6 is an obvious one, CD 56 as well, and some others. So I think this is a strategy you have to go for it. Yeah, there are some other type of cell-based immunotherapies that may be worth it. We are now able to engineer CARs, and we are able to engineer infiltrating lymphocytes that are expanded ex vivo, and we have the opportunity to engineer them to produce actually T-cell engagers or let's say some other immune checkpoint modulators, so that when you administer them to the patient back, those cells go into the tumor and actually produce intratumorally the agent we allow to produce. So the cell is acting actually as a factory intratumorally of the drug we are interested on, such as a PD-1 inhibitor or a T-cell engager and so on. So those type of strategies, I think they are pretty interesting. We have to combine them with novel chemotherapies. I think the ability of lorbanectedin and some of the agents in this class, ATR inhibitors, PARP inhibitors, the ability to actually modulate the immune landscape should be taking advantage of when combined with other drugs. The same is true as well with these novel topo 1 poisons, such as the AVI compound, the ADC against the 6-6. And I think this is very much when I see what I see into the very near future.
Yeah. And any other agents that you're excited about for small cell?
Yeah, I think if we can exploit the tumor microenvironment, the desert, or however you want to refer to it, the moon, by T-cell engagers or CAR-T or other ways of manipulating the immune system, I think that's really exciting, as Louise mentioned. Other approaches, not really prime time yet, but I think, again, exploiting the actual characteristics of small cell, the rapid proliferation time, somehow, you know, exploiting metabolomics, or whether it's arginine or sugar, and different approaches there. I don't think there's anything in prime time, but I'm glad people are thinking about that.
Louisa, you know, just real quickly, I know we're running close on time here. Why has drug development been so tough in small cell?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One is that if you look at the molecular disturbance underlying small cell lung cancer, there is no oncogene addiction behind. It's mainly abnormalities in tumor suppressors, and those are very difficult to target. So that is one part. The other part is that the tumor microenvironment is very immunosuppressive, so immunotherapy is not being very effective till recently. And the third thing is that the disease itself is more difficult to study as compared to others, because we have very little tissue from those patients, and maybe we didn't advance as much into the knowledge of the biology till recently. So all those things are really important factors. Lastly, I think patients tend to be very unhealthy. So because of the comorbidities, but also because of the small cell lung cancer itself, and therefore, very often, those are not even candidates for novel therapies. So I would say a number of conditions and peculiarities make this disease very difficult to advance in terms of novel therapeutics.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And any other barriers in terms of drug development here?
Yeah, I would say that the fact that many of our patients have persistent CNS disease is really difficult to treat. Some of my patients have great control of their disease in the lung and or other parts of their body, but just have persistent recurrence in the brain. So we need something for those patients, and we need to develop something there. And I would say, you know, the other thing is, these patients, actually, we're quite good at treating them. You know, they have great response rates up front. We just have to figure out how to annihilate the persistent cells that, or we need to figure out how to kill the cells that persist. And perhaps that's going back to thinking about the stem cells. That certainly was the approach for the DLL, DLL notch therapies. But I think we do need to figure out how to tweak the immune system such that they can see and get rid of those persistent cells.
Luis, one more question here. What about maintenance therapy, you know, before relapse? As Anne mentioned, you know, we get that initial response. Maintenance approaches, do they show a lot of promise?
Well, you know, I think this is a space that we should maybe try to study a bit further. In the past, we have seen that chemotherapy, even immunotherapy, were not effective as maintenance therapies if they were not given as an induction therapy. However, I would say I foresee now ways to actually emphasize the maintenance therapy. For example, we have seen in some trials that the combination of PD-L1 inhibitors with lorbrenectedin is at least additive, not only in preclinical experiments, but also in some clinical trials. And now, actually, we are testing this therapeutic strategy on the maintenance setting, maybe a way to further expand the benefit from maintenance immunotherapy in that very context. Secondly, we are also doing trials with tarlatamab in combination with PD-L1 inhibitors. There is a strong rationale not only from clinical data, but also for the combination of those agents in immunocompetent animal models. So I would say it's a pretty reasonable strategy, I would say. If something is working in the second and third line, maybe giving that a bit earlier is going to help us to squeeze a bit more the benefit from that specific strategy.
Yeah, I had a couple more questions I wanted to ask, but we are running out of time here. So let me just take a second to thank both of you for coming and for all the work that you're doing for patients in this space. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was really a pleasure.
And Luis, thanks again for being our guest here.
Thank you very much indeed.
And thanks everyone for listening to this episode of Lung Cancer Considered, the official IASLC podcast. You can listen to our other episodes on SoundCloud, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on our website, iaslc.org. Bye-bye.